My name is Bill Callahan. I'm the chief economist at the Trades Union Congress, and it's my honour and my pleasure to chair this lecture, the third in the 1999 Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures. We have, I think, today a distinguished lecturer following a long line of distinguished lecturers in this series: Rudy Dornbusch, Lester Thoreau, William Baumol, to name but a few. And it's an honour, I think, to be associated with this series of lectures. It's a particular pleasure for me because Richard Freeman's work is of direct relevance to what I do. Very few economists connect, I think, in the way that Richard does to the work of trade unions. Whether it's about youth unemployment, whether it's about worker share schemes, whether it's about minimum wages, Richard has always written and spoken in a lively and informative way. And just thinking about my experience on the Low Pay Commission, the paper that you wrote with Danny Blanchflower on youth unemployment was one of the most quoted pieces of work in our deliberations. So that's really enough from me. Richard's already been introduced during this series of lectures, and I now hand over to Richard, and I think following his presentation of his third lecture, there'll then be a chance for questions and answers and discussion. So Richard, over to you.
I want to do today four things. One is talk about this, what we call the War of the Models, which is, you've all read about this. That's the battle between various capitalist institutions, between different variants of capitalism. And I want to make the argument that in this war, in fact, we should think about this not as a single victor, but I'm going to give some evidence and arguments for the belief that, in fact, capitalism allows for a lot of diversity of institutions. Then I want to tell you about a cloning experiment I've done, which I believe is the first cloning experiment in economics, and give you some results from that experiment. Third, I want to talk about some attitudes, which gets back to the first lecture about we care, but I want to see some of these attitudes expressed in attitudes towards society as opposed to do you return Bill Callahan's wallet if you find it lying somewhere on the floor here. And then finally, I want to try to do, which is the hardest part, is put the three lectures together into a package. And I'm still struggling with that. I mean, that's the virtue of a lecture like this, lecture series. You're forced to do this. But the first, let's talk about this war of the models. And those of you who watch television late at night and are terribly bored, which is often the case, you're sitting in a hotel room, sometimes you flick on and you see American professional wrestling. So I see some people do know this. And I've always thought of the War of the Models as basically a professional wrestling match. Now, one of the type of matches that they have are called battle royales. And in a battle royale, what you put in this big ring, various wrestlers come, and in the scheme supposedly is the last one left in the ring is the winner. I think of the ring as, of course, the global marketplace. And the competitors, there are a bunch of them. The one that I think is probably the current favorite in this battle is, of course, the American model. And I believe Mr. Blair is selling some parts of this to some of the Europeans a little while ago. This model has some virtues. We're going to go through some of the virtues of this model. It has some defects, and Americans probably understand the defects better than at least some Europeans do. And we'll go through those. The second model that we have in this battle, you see, you can see an American guy comes marching up with an Uncle Sam hat or something into the ring, and they have all kinds of music. And then you have a second contestant. He's slightly flabby from probably too many sausages and beer, doing social partnership discussions. He's often referred to as the Rhineland model. And if you go back 7 or 8 years, the Germans were very adamant this was a great model. You no longer hear quite the confidence about that. But nonetheless, it's pretty clear they're not overly happy with an Anglo-Saxon model either. The third contestant I would put into this ring is the social democratic dream model, or extreme model, and I think of this as being the Viking, and because all these professional wrestlers have to have their gimmick, so this person would come in a Viking outfit, and that of course is the Nordic model, which you can think of Sweden, and Norway, Finland, Denmark, but we've always thought of Sweden as being the prize of this situation. And some of my American friends said it was, Sweden has not done very well of the last 10 or 15 years. They used to say, well, you know, it was very irritating. The Swedes would come and they would tell us that they had everything down right. They knew just how to do it. And boom. And these are people who are favorably inclined to the Swedish Nordic style model. But they said it sure was nice to see them get some comeuppance. That they didn't have everything down perfectly, but there they are. Now I don't quite know what to do with the next contestant who would come into the ring. And I imagine this person being led by a very fierce looking woman carrying an umbrella. And if you know American professional wrestling matches, there's often an elderly woman with a hat pin who sticks the hat pin, in principle, into the bad wrestler, the villains of the piece. And I sometimes have described this wrestler as he has on it a CBI and TUC love shirt, which is a social partnership thing. And at one point I thought it would be, you could call this model Cool Britannia, but that doesn't seem to be the phrase chosen. We could call it the Third Way, but no one knows what that is. So we'd have a big question mark on the tank shirt. But it is what I think that the British government ideally is trying to do is to strive some new variant somewhere in between the Americans and the Europeans. As you probably all know, from the middle of Europe, not far from Maastricht, we have the Dutch model, which is probably the only half-time employed economy in the world. Everybody, we'll see some statistics, I exaggerate, it's everybody. But it's really an interesting experiment with very few hours of work. A lot of part-time labor in the Netherlands. They've been quite successful. At one point, I thought about we had these Asian tigers, but they didn't get into the ring for this match, I think. We know the Russians are not getting into the ring for this match. And it would be wonderful if we had a little leprechaun coming into the ring that would fit with all the way the professional wrestling shows operate. And we know the Irish are doing really well in their economy. But the notion is that you have these different models in this battle. And the usual way the professional wrestling thing operates is everybody gets thrown out but one. And here I've described this as the single peak landscape for capitalist institutions. And a lot of the discussion of these models is people have in their mind the idea there is some ideal way of organizing our capitalist system. And we had all better get onto that bandwagon. I'm going to argue against that. That is not a good interpretation of the data. At one point, oh my goodness, I forgot one of the models. Who did I forget? It's the guy who comes just in time from the airport from Tokyo. And I'm forgetting him, and he was the big favorite just a few years ago, because he's not doing so well now. But you go back 6 or 7 years, and the best-selling business book in the United States was a book written by a Japanese samurai wrestler and swordsman of the 14th, 15th century. And there were not only, it was called the Ring of the, I've forgotten now exactly the title, I haven't read it for a while. But they actually had two editions in the US, and it was number one among business people. Because it was, the idea was, if you read how the Japanese samurai thought, you then could fight back against those powerful Japanese competitors. And that's probably a model we should have in this ring as well. But the notion is that there's some single peak. It could be the Japanese, as American businessmen thought 5, 6 years ago. It could be the Germans, the Rhineland thing, as the Germans thought a few years ago. It could be the Americans. It would be very nice. I don't think we're at all prepared to say, but it would be very nice if one could say 5 or 6 years down the road, it could be the British with the new labor situation. But it's a very strong view to believe that there's a single peak to capitalism, that there's only one way, one institutional structure that we have to do. It's laissez-faire, deregulated right now. And the Japanese, it was thought of as a very different way. So I have here what I call the multiple peaks version. Multiple peaks means, gee, we can vary our institutions. And if we are the Germans with our, you know, social partnership stuff, well, if we do that well, we can be at a peak. This peak may be a little lower than this peak, a little higher. Hard to tell from my writing, and I didn't have any particular desire to make one higher than the other. But here I drew three, you know, there might be five peaks. And the trick is, though, the moving from one peak to the other is costly. So if the Germans really wanted to adopt an American-style system, or the Americans wanted to adopt, as many of our businesses were trying to do, a Japanese-style system, it'd be pretty expensive. You are going to go down the mountain before you get up to the next peak, because there are a lot of institutions and a lot of things sort of are interconnected, and they work together to make the system work. And I think the economy that most exhibits this particular pattern probably is the Swedish. The Swedes have gone away from the centralized bargaining system that they had. They've tried to reduce taxes. They reduced taxes some. They tried to move towards a more a less strong welfare state, social democratic type system. And it may very well be that peak is better, and they weren't doing all that great, so they made their decision with some knowledge. But they never thought that they would run into the big problems that they have. And Sweden is fallen in the GDP per capita league tables by extraordinary amount. I think it is this effort to switch and change your system. It may be necessary to change it, but it's costly. The last view, I called this many roads. I don't know, I could have called it flat peak or something else. Danny Carl, think of some good time, good thing for it. What I meant was that it's not so hard to switch from one to the other. That if the United Kingdom wants to become more, adopt some American practices, not so difficult. You don't have to go through a big cost pattern. And maybe all of our systems, we can just move around as we choose. And if you think of this as being, let's say, a more institutional structure, and this is a less institutional structure, you can indeed adjust relatively costlessly. So I think the right way of thinking about this war of the models is, first, to what extent is this in fact a single peak versus the other two are diversity areas. And I'm going to basically argue this one doesn't hold up too much. Let me give you some of the arguments people make. Yeah, and I call this the single peak diversity. Well, single peak, you have to, if you believe there's a single peak, you have to identify the dominant institution, the structure. I said put the USA because that's the current favorite. But you should be very suspicious immediately when you sort of look and say, well, it was the Japanese 6 years ago. When Clinton got in, for his first term, there was incredible interest in German institutions. And they were talking about apprenticeships and this is and that's is. And so it turns out, I think, the leaders vary a lot over time. And I'm going to give you some evidence in a minute. You also would expect if there's a single peak that particular society dominates on almost all or virtually all criterion. We're going to see instead the leaders vary a lot by outcome. So if we focus on one outcome, we'll say, oh yeah, that's something the US does very well. We focus on another outcome, we'll say, oh, that's something the Japanese do pretty well. And that clearly is a case for diversity as opposed to a single peak. You hear a lot of arguments, often by people on the left, that globalization is going to require a convergence to a single peak. So maybe we're not there, but boy, everybody's going to be forced. And if you're opposed to globalization, you use the word the low road. It's going to force you down the low road, and there's going to be social dumping. You hear that through various European discussions. I think that's completely wrong. Completely probably exaggerates, because no economist should ever use too strong language. But I don't think it's right. I argue the evidence is against it. And for three reasons. First is when we talk often about competitiveness and that some country has a more extensive social welfare system. And often you see this discussion, the French will look and say, oh my gosh, all those social charges are half the labor cost. That's incredible. You got to get rid of them. It's so expensive. Well, the fact is most economic evidence and most economists would argue that most economics says that workers pay the bulk of payroll taxes. If half of the French labor cost is for benefits to workers, I promise you the wages of the French workers are lower than they otherwise would have been. So to think of this as creating a competitive disadvantage is simply not correct. If a union comes in and bargains for a greater pension system or for some benefits for its workers, it's probably going to have to take a smaller wage increase. There's a total compensation that is there. Most studies would say workers pay this tax. Two, of course, if a country in fact is in the situation that it's putting extra charges on because it wants to have some social institutions that are not productive, it can depreciate its currency. And then you compete in the world market and you just say, we took a little bit lower value of our currency in order so our goods could compete even though they cost us more to produce because we wanted to use that money to buy some social goods. No reason why we have to go down a low road or et cetera. And then, go back to the first talk we had, consumers are often willing to pay for higher standards. So if in fact you're producing a high quality product or a product made under good conditions and you publicize that and you tell people that, they're willing to pay for it. So I don't see there's anything that says in economics that says because we're trading with other countries, we are going to be forced down this low road towards social dumping. We have a set of options. You obviously can see that the euro is going to remove one of the options that some European countries had, namely depreciation of currency to compete with here. Then There's a point which my colleague Danny Roderick has made very nicely, that globalization raises the cost of non-productive state redistributions. It's going to be a bit more expensive because there are more competitors out there and the demand curves have become more elastic. So at one point we might have said, well, we want to do a non-productive thing to redistribute money to certain people. That's European. You could think of some European welfare states doing that. And if we don't have too many global competitors, we have a limited loss of jobs or loss of sales. But if we have more and more global competitors, the demand curve for our product has gotten more elastic. So whenever we drop trade barriers, presumably the demand curve gets more elastic. Well, some sharing outcomes are productive, and others have very modest cost. It is remarkable when you compare the EU, and particularly Germany, with the United States. The costs at current exchange values of German workers are extraordinary compared to American workers, in the manufacturing sector in particular. Germany runs a trade surplus. The United States runs a trade deficit. So there must be something about the skill levels of the Germans and so on that means that they are capable of competing even with what I would think would be an overvalued mark. So I think it's a very iffy proposition and shows very little faith in a lot of these institutions to think that they are all either non-productive or are immensely expensive to operate. Then there's an interesting issue that I just started to think about, which is the internet, the spread of modern technology. Now, and there's two views. I'm not quite sure who's right on this one. We don't have the evidence in. And you think of the World Wide Web in particular. But one view would be spread of modern technology creates winner-take-all contests. I could, in my little town, I'm the best singer. And if there was no radio, television, whatever, people would pay a little bit of money for me to sing. They wouldn't pay any money for me to sing. When I was in kindergarten, the teacher asked me, please don't sing. It was unfortunate. You're always allowed to sing in the shower, we know that. So as modern technology spreads, suddenly you're competing with some super singer. And nobody's going to pay for you to do the singing. So there is a way in which this does create the one superstar. And we have the superstar, and how do you compete with the superstar? You don't. That guy gets all the money, that person, and that's the winner-take-all kind of a strategy. The alternative, though, is equally valid, I think, as intellectually at least. That the technology creates niches of diversity. As the technology allows us more and more television stations, you think of there'll be 100 television stations there, however many you get from these the newest things. Well, gee, that's very different from when you have the BBC One and BBC Two and ITV and Channel 4. And it has to be that fewer people will be watching those four stations. And that creates an opportunity for more diversity. Maybe I can get my own show singing. Maybe not too many people will watch it, but there'll be many more peculiar shows and so on. And you think of the World Wide Web. There must be some tendency for convergence of things, but on the other hand, there is incredible diversity out there. So I'm not sure about this one. My heart lies clearly with I prefer to see the diversity, and it probably depends. But I call this a debate. I don't think it's a fully, I can say absolutely one side is right on the debate. I want to give you what evidence we have that argues, as I see, for the diversity as opposed to the single peak. And the next slide gives you the models. And I won't say very much about them. We talked about them already. American, Rhineland, Viking, Polder, that's for the Dutch guys, Japanese, Third Way, and Leprechaun at the bottom. But you know, we may see, if France does well, we could see the French model suddenly being discussed widely as the right way to go. When I was a student, or even before I was a student, I think, there was, because I think we read books post this, the French indicative planning was said to be the way to go. Because France had a very, very rapid growth rate in the 1960s, and they, in principle, had this indicative planning where the guys in Paris sort of suggested what was going to happen to everybody. And economists, in our infinite wisdom, devised rationales as to why this was good. Because if the planner told you, it said, look, we're really going to be growing, having a lot more transportation system, then people could make investment in machines that would create, you know, more buses or whatever it happens to be, and they pretty well knew there was going to be a market there, so it reduced some uncertainty. That was the argument. Okay. Now I want to go through the economic performance and show you that there isn't any clear leader in this process. So this is filled with numbers, which usually is a bad sign. But I just want to give you a set of numbers. And I've put the English-speaking guys here, the Japanese all by themselves. There are the EU, and here's the Nordic characters, the Rhinelandish type guys. Well, I don't know where the French belong. What you quickly notice is, take the U.S., and here the U.K. is pretty good as well. We are really good at high employment population rates. And the U.S. in particular, now this is 1997, the U.S. unemployment rate is now down to what, 4.5, 4.3. It's extremely successful. This is hours worked per year. That's basically no vacations. That's what that hours comes to. Because you can do 40 times 52, and you quickly see, boy, they're not taking any time off. I say the U.K. shows its European heart by taking some vacations. So do the Canadians. But you're not remotely in the league of the Germans. Or the Dutch, who are the lowest. That's an extraordinary, that's 50%, you know, the Americans are 50% more, they're more than 50% less because of the way percentages go. The Nordic guys have also generally had high employment rate. And there was a whole school of thinking at one point which said, it's best to be very decentralized because you have high employment rates, or very centralized with the centralized bargaining. And at one point I was an advisor to the Dutch government, and the Dutch were sitting there saying, you know, we're right in the middle of this. That must mean we're in the worst possible state. And of course, the Dutch have been very successful of late. Then I put some growth rates here. And that's GDP per capita, compensation in the business sector, and productivity in the business sector. And suddenly, it doesn't look so great. UK doesn't look great on that. But the US has a pretty fast GDP per capita. It's going to be a little bit faster as we get to 97 and 98. But gosh, the Japanese, with all their failure, grew faster in the 1990s than the Americans did per capita. The Germans did. The Dutch, of course, did, because they had a big success. And you just look and you say, well, not so. Sweden did very poorly. That one's not so clear. So you add a few more years and the Americans look a little bit better. But it's certainly not going to be any dominance of growth rates at all. You go to compensation, and suddenly the Americans look worse. That's what workers are taking home. Germans don't look so good over this period. Germany's in a recession. Germany's not doing well of this particular time period. But the Americans are, New Zealand, as you know, adopted all of the Thatcher reforms they could. And they have yet to recover from those reforms. It's striking. If you ever read The Economist, every year or two would have a New Zealand story. I used to cut these out. And every year the story would be something like this. New Zealand did just what they should have. You know, They got rid of the weakened the unions greatly. They did, and a lot of stuff that they did, you know, they got rid of a lot of tariffs, things you would all think are probably good. And we're just waiting for them to come back. And each year they would get worse and worse. And then finally, about 4 or 5 years ago, they made a slight recovery. There was a big article. Finally it hits. Well, the Australians have done much, much better without any of this stuff. And New Zealand is wobbling again. So that's an interesting case. But in general, the Americans are at the bottom of this. And then you have productivity. And the productivity figures, there's variation among the countries, but there's no clear dominance at all. Oh, certainly not. You would like to see, if the U.S. were the single dominant character, you'd like to see, this is high, this low, this I'm not sure whether you want to see it high or low, but you'd like to see these really big. And they're not. When we thought of the Japanese as being the coming model, it was, the Japanese had very, very high. The growth rate was 6% a year, and you could see everybody forecasting at what year they're going to surpass the GDP of the U.S. or could be the EU, which is about the same for this. So we have this set of things which just don't show this overwhelming dominance. Now, more striking, I'm going to give you two sets of data here, is if we start asking, for whom is this are these different economies working best? And so what I've got is the per capita income, and then the income of people in different parts of the income distribution. The U.S. does have the highest per capita income, and has had it for a long, long time. Then you look down the countries, and I'm sad to say, there's only one country that the U.K. is ahead of in this table, and that's New Zealand. And one of the striking things to me, we have a project we're going to be starting at the CEP, is that the UK has literally not moved in the entire period of the last 15, 20 years. And with all the reforms that were done and changes, it's striking. It hasn't gone, up. Sweden went way down. Sweden used to be up there, up behind Switzerland, and went way down. And terribly, if you're a Swede or Norwegian, you understand, boy, it really is upsetting for the Swedes that they are poorer than the Norwegians. I suppose the same way it would be upsetting if Ireland turned out to have 20% higher per capita income than the UK. People would just say, oh, that's quite a change. But one doesn't know how these things will go. Now, that's the per capitas. And it's ranked. And I'll take the U.S., because right now, I don't want to knock the U.S., but if the U.S. is the current one that people are saying is the lead model, I got to knock it a little bit to show you that it really isn't the dominant capitalist thing. Look at the lower decile. We go down the list looking for somebody else. These incomes are relative to the U.S. per capita. Everything is relative to U.S. per capita. So a lower decile person would make 36% of U.S. per capita. A Swiss person in the lower decile would make 52% of U.S. per capita. So that's the way we could read it very nicely. You go down and you say, finally we get to Canada. Well, Canada, which is 23% poorer by this measure, it's lower decile people are about the same as the Americans. Then we keep going down, but we get to the Australians. You'll quickly see it's all English-speaking guys at the bottom of this stuff, and we get to the UK. The UK is quite a bit poorer, and in this calculation, turns out to be the lower decile poorer than the Americans, and actually, the New Zealand turns out to be a little bit better. We go to the upper decile, and it's wonderful to be rich in the United States. And you can go down the list. You see, some of the countries are quite high. Don't do so well for the rich, the Danes, and that's your Viking kind of model, your social democratic thing. Your Swedes and your Finns are pretty low by this calculation. Since you're lower decile, Sweden and Finland 39, that really made that, but so be it. It's worth double checking that number. I have another chart, because that one was dealing with per capita income. And now I'm going to give you compensation of workers. The best data that I could get was hourly production workers, because the USBLS does a very nice job of tabulating these for all the nations with which we do a considerable trade. And these are in purchasing power parity things. So none of this is exchange rate. So these are what people can really buy. Well, it's before taxes. So we haven't. There is no tax adjustment here. But then there's no also adjustment for the benefit. So the Americans pay less taxes, but we buy our health insurance from our compensation. And most Europeans in the UK, you get your health insurance as part of your tax system. Here we find, these are now for production workers, blue collar workers. The US is suddenly no longer the highest, even on hourly compensation. The Germans, I said, were just way above. But it's all these even the Canadians, who have much stronger unions at this point than we do, than the Americans. The UK is now down here about with the Japanese. So the Japanese are not great payers of their production workers. And then I again do the decile thing. And here you see, well, I'll take the Americans. They're just about, the UK and Australia, New Zealand. All the English-speaking guys, once again, are at the bottom of this thing. But the Americans almost managed to get to the top for their highest paid workers. They're second to the Germans on that. The point I want to make is that even if we looked at one of these measures and said, who is doing better, we have to bring in the distribution of income. Because you have to say who is doing better for whom, and there's quite a bit of variation. The Americans model does great for people who are really highly paid, and they do really poor for people who are low paid. Obviously, it's better for everybody to have higher wages or higher incomes, and some of the other countries clearly distribute their income differently, so the lower paid people are closer to the average. Well, that's just the difference of inequality between the systems. But if, and you can think about how you decide whether one measure or one society is better than another. Well, you might have said if at every part of the income distribution, one society has got higher incomes, then it clearly meets any test we want to put, any sort of welfare thing. And if we had the U.S. or the U.K. versus, India, we might find that to be the case. That would be higher at every point, and we could say, yes, these societies clearly outproduce. But in fact, when we talk about these capitalist societies, what we tend to find is it really varies as to which part of the income distribution is doing better in the different countries. It's better to be poor in Europe, and it's better to be rich in the United States. Which is why some superstar athletes have left Sweden and other countries and take their homes, elsewhere. But in any sort of social welfare evaluation, we've got to weigh that as we feel, how much poorer, how much wealthier, so on. But the minute you bring the distribution in, there clearly isn't any overwhelming, capitalist leader. Now, there's another argument you might want to make for why the single peak argument. And that would be if everybody's getting closer together. And that's part of the global, et cetera. I want to show you that if we take labor institutions, exactly the opposite has been occurring. There has been a divergence between the capitalist countries. They're not all getting together. And so I categorize these in 1, 2, 3, 4 groups, with a slight sloppiness for Australia, one or two of them. These are declining density and declining coverage. Tends to be the English-speaking countries, minus Canada, and Japan. These are union density figures, and there's union coverage figures. And they're falling. And they're falling a lot in these different countries. If you took the private sector of certainly of the UK and the US, it would be even sharper, the drops. And I assume the same would be true of New Zealand and Australia. Australia, the decline in coverage is much less. You're talking about 80% covered. There's no crisis in that sense. Then we have a set of countries which have unionization is going down, but coverage is actually stable or rising. Austria has had a large decline in union coverage. France, whatever the numbers may mean, had a decline. Even Germany has had a drop in union coverage, according to the OECD figures. Italy, the Netherlands. The Netherlands is the one I know. I've studied this, and because it's this fact that you could have a drop in density of 9 percentage points and have an increase in collective bargaining coverage just struck me as absolutely bizarre. I mean, because it's inconceivable in the US or UK. But what's, and I unfortunately, I don't know anything about that, but it's here. What goes on is the Netherlands, Germany, France, Austria, and even Italy to some extent, have national bargaining, or they have extensions of contracts. They have institutions such that the collective bargaining contract establishes the pay throughout the society. And so it doesn't matter all that much your union density. Obviously, you get weaker and weaker, you can be less and less important. But the unions, you don't have to panic. When I spoke with the Dutch unions, there was no panic that their density was falling. They said, well, we got to do something about getting more people. But how do you get the people to join the union if, when we ask them to join, they say, why should I? I'm already covered by the contract. Why should I pay you, you know, a fee for this? And so you have to think of other things. But the density, coverage actually going up. Then we get a set of countries with stable density and coverage, including Canada. And finally, we have rising density and stable or rising coverage. Boom. What I did was I calculated the coefficient of variation of these figures. And they clearly go up. They don't go down. So we are not seeing a convergence of labor market institutions, where I'm taking the trade unions as being the critical measure. There may be some convergence of you know, of certain government programs, or welfare programs probably, or smaller budget, the Maastricht things in Europe. They certainly became smaller in the United States. But the key institution in many societies is the trade unions. And instead, what we're seeing is exactly the opposite. Some level, what we're seeing is a move towards very strong, you know, 100% collective bargaining things, and a real decline in some others. And it's a very, we're in the middle of an extremely interesting set of things, both here with the new labor, the new labor law, which we will see if there is a change in the density and coverage. And in the US, we've just had a massive, the biggest organizing success since they organized the Harvard workers about 12 years ago. They've organized 70,000 workers in the state of California. And I don't, not predicting any change, but it could very well be. But the idea that all the countries are going down the same path on unionism is just not true. Unions are changing, just the way companies are changing. People are adopting different policies and so on. But there just doesn't seem to be any push for this kind of convergence. Well, I picked this measure because it's really a nice one, i.e. the OECD publishes it on a cross-national basis. But you can look at other things. Now I want to switch, because I want to make it clear that the key variable, the key thing that institutions do, is they don't, let me phrase it this way, an intelligent set of institutions do not affect the efficiency of the economy very much. That's my diversity type argument. Or you can organize them so that you're at one of these peaks. But what they do is they have a huge effect on the distribution. I think that's the key thing on which to see differences across these societies. And this is my cloning experiment. What I did was the following. I took a set of fetuses in Sweden, and I cloned them before they did this Dolly thing. I just did it in a slightly different way, which I'll explain to you the way economists do this. I moved those fetuses to the United States, and I brought them up in America. And what I have here are income distribution figures for all Americans. This is a 90-10 decile ratio, so that shows how much big inequality is in the U.S. Then I have my U.S. Swedes. Those are my clones of the Swedes. Now, in reality, of course, I couldn't really do the cloning. Economists don't have that technical skill. Although I'm sure we will. I mean, it would not shock me 100 years from now somebody says, that's the way I'll do the experiment, unless some moral people stop them. What I did was the following. I took people in the U.S. census of population, not immigrants, because that's a very peculiar group of folks, but people who said both of their parents were Swedish. People who said they were of Swedish ancestry. There's a question, is your ancestry this? And there are a lot of them. Let me just say, there are a lot of them living in Minnesota, indeed. That's where they hang out. It's cold and, you know, et cetera. And that doesn't show overly great taste by my Swedish friends. But also, Minnesota's a very nice state, just as if you've been there. So we have the U.S. Swedes. Then we have the Swedes in Sweden. This consists all the immigrants in Sweden they've taken out. These are only people who said both of their parents were Swedish. So we've got, so the clone isn't, you know, exactly right, but it's basically people of exactly, you know, the same background and the same, come from the same gene pool in that sense. What you see is, oh my God. Now, when I first did this, I'll tell you what I expected and why this is just blazoned itself in my mind. I thought I was going to get something like this. I thought I'd find the U.S. Swede somewhere like here. Americans are very diverse. We've got all, this includes all different minority groups, all different ethnic groups. And I thought, well, surely if I pick a homogenous group of people in the U.S., I should get less thing. And then you could imagine, like I thought of the following. Gee, this has the flavor of all these genetic twin studies. I will then be able to report to the world how much of the variance of income inequality is, quote, genetically based. You know, you have to take a certain model to do that. And how much is environmentally based. This result is that it's all environment. There is no, I mean, this is a slight difference here. But it's so slight that I wouldn't pay any attention to it. Because it may very well be, if I'd taken this number, the U.S., and instead of doing all the Americans pooled, if I'd taken ethnic group by ethnic group and averaged, I might have gotten something lower here. So the lesson here is that institutions determine distributions. That's the one thing we're certain of. We can't show that some of these capitalist systems produce better long-term growth. We can't show they produce some things, but this we see they can. And this here is just showing the 10th decile to the median, which is simply the lowest group relative to the average. It's the same picture. So taking as close as a cloning experiment as one could do, one sees that the real place the institutions matter, and they matter strongly, is in distribution aspect. Now, you start thinking of the following. The different societies have chosen different institutional structures. And some of the Europeans have chosen more narrow income distributions. And I say, I use the word choice. It may not have been chosen by some central planner, but chosen by, after fights with unions and things, this kind of thing, but chosen. So it's possible that this reflects the tastes of the people. I want to give you some evidence. Across countries, and since Richard Laird is here, I put in Russia. There's some Russian data. It's the following. To show you that, in fact, what goes on is the top line is the perceived inequality, and the bottom line is what we call justifiable inequality. What do I mean by that? People were asked two questions about a whole bunch of occupations. How much do you think people make in that occupation? They're asked actually about 11 occupations, and it's an international survey. And I picked here the executive pay divided by the unskilled as a good picture. And what you see is, gee, the Australians say this, the Brits say that they observe this. The Brits must be here, because this must be the Americans. Yeah. The Americans are number one in perceiving executives being more paid than unskilled workers. Well, that's true. The Brits are second in this. The third, the Russians, in the process. But what's striking is when we then asked, how much do you think these people should be paid? They were never asked an explicit inequality question. They were asked, well, how much do you think people in these occupations should be paid? I call that the justifiable. It's lower in every country by almost the exact same proportion. I was really amazed at this. You can see it's just about the same. It's about 75%. There's some variance, but I sort of was struck by this, which says something like the following. In every country, even in, we don't have Sweden here, do we? But we have Norway. Even in Norway, where there is no income inequality as far as any outside observer can see, the people say, oh, there should be a little more equality. It's a revealed preference. It's not a, that's where we did this. By the same amount elsewhere. And now you can understand a little bit the problem I think the US and the UK have in this world. Inequality's gone up in our countries. But everybody sort of has raised their view of what the justifiable inequality is. Because everybody seems to have the same idea that you discount somewhat the degree of inequality. And my reading of this could be a controversial interpretation, is that basically what people are doing is looking out at the degree of inequality in their society, taking that as a base thing, and then saying, gee, it's not quite fair. There should be some reduction of that inequality, regardless of the level, so that it is a socially determined preference or view or numbers. And we have some time series numbers for a couple of the countries, just four. And the German one doesn't quite fit, but three of them show that as inequality rose between 89, I think it's 86, I have to double check the year, but somewhere in the mid-80s to the early 90s, the justifiable inequality rose as well. Germany, that didn't happen. I'm puzzled by that. The next to last graph, we're almost done, does the same thing with a more general metric. And this just takes the standard deviation of the log pay in 11 occupations. So this question was asked of 11 occupations. The executive over the unskilled, sort of captures the heart of it. It's the exact same thing. A country that has a higher perceived inequality has a higher justifiable inequality. That's that. So I don't think you want to start off saying, oh, those Swedes, they just have innately some stronger taste. We know it's not in this genetic thing from my cloning experiment. It probably also isn't something that comes out of some we may argue over this, but I would say, as a good economist, I would say it's not something that comes out of culture either. It comes out of this thing three quarters. You basically want to reduce the inequality by about a quarter, no matter what it is. And you may have trouble conceiving reducing more. If you are in the United States, the idea that you'd greatly reduce the pay of the CEOs you talk to people and say, well, gee, can we reduce the pay of the CEOs so they only really took home $1 million a year? Oh my God. You try to say, well, you know, 15 years ago, that is what they took home. And the pay of the average American has barely gone up. So wouldn't that just bring us back to what we were X years ago? But nobody would think that way. You'd say, well, they're getting 2 million a year, maybe we reduce it to 1.8 million a year. That appears to be the way people operate. Okay. So now I want to conclude the lecture series with Exhibit 9 and discuss a little bit about the connections. So I phrased it modestly, if my three propositions are correct. And for those of you who have been for all three things, you know what they are. Those of you who don't, the first proposition was that we care about the economic well-being and fairness of outcomes. I view that as a consumption aspect. And the difference between that and the we care and what was yesterday, these participative, we shared decisions, having workers play a greater role at workplaces and so on, and sharing in financial rewards, that's a production decision. There probably is some linkage between these two. And today someone was discussing with me these things and actually suggested what should be a very interesting experiment that we will do. He didn't realize he was suggesting an experiment to me, but I was listening. It would be very interesting to see whether people who go through a greater sharing, meaning employee owners in United Airlines or something, whether they show any greater caring towards the people outside their group, or they could show less. There may be some connection to this. I've sort of, in the study, the economic studies of this are totally separate. But think of this as consumption, this is production. And today, it's really about moving to a third level, the entire institutional framework of the society. And there, the argument is that capitalism is sufficiently sturdy to allow for variety. There isn't this real single peak that everybody has to go down. Obviously, you can make big blunders. I mean, we look and we see Russia as a communist system, we see Russia as a capitalist system, and we know you can screw things up badly. So sturdy doesn't mean it can survive every kind of shock. And then from these three things, that there are people who do care, that you can do at least as well through some more sharing of economic decisions, and that this whole system is a sturdy system. Now, why is it sturdy? It's sturdy for one, I think, fundamental reason. It's very important. And here, I think the American model does have something to say to the Europeans. What makes the capitalism work is entry and exit of new competitors. Because if somebody is really being a jerk in their, you know, in their production, they're not doing the right kind of things, a new guy should be allowed to go in and push them off. Some of the European countries, like Sweden, have a tax system that has traditionally been tilted in favor of the large existing firms. It's remarkable in some sense when you look at the Swedish tax system. It's been reformed a bit, but it's still, you sort of look and you say, what are they doing? They're basically having a tax system meant to benefit. There are like five or six super wealthy Swiss families. And this tax system is meant to benefit them. It's meant to benefit their companies, which then actually make deals with the trade unions, and the workers get their share through that. But the Swedes have had their troubles of late. But the key thing why I think there is sturdiness is it's competition between different institutions, different forms, and so on. But accepting that, I then say, well, it's an option. We have a possibility of choosing more or less sharing of our prosperity. We can go down a very unequal route. And that's sort of the one level I reach, at least the bad news for people of some vintage, at least. It's good news for the super wealthy who are not, or for some other folks. I think we could live with great inequality. Capitalism is sufficiently sturdy, it can live that way. And I've thought about this in terms of, I called it an apartheid economy to get people's attention. Where you have income distribution terribly separated, the people from the suburbs don't go into the inner city. You don't go out to those horrible housing estates. Those people live there. You have enough police and enough things that they don't come and bother you too much. And I think that's a viable, but not very desirable solution to the capitalist thing. So, because it is a very sturdy institution. And you can look at some third world countries which are capitalist. Brazil is incredible inequality. It goes along. Sometimes it does well, sometimes it does poorly, but it lives with astounding inequality. I think most people in Europe would not have believed, I wouldn't have believed 15 years ago, that Spain could live with 20% unemployment for year in and year out. And that a lot of the countries which traditionally had 1 to 2% unemployment could live with 10% unemployment. I mean, because there's an inequality in Europe. The inequality in the U.S. is on income. The inequality in Europe is in unemployment. There's an inequality there, too. But I think we've seen in Europe you can live with high unemployment, and in the U.S. we can live with high inequality. So that leads me to conclude my part of this stuff, because I'm not a politician or a union leader or anything like that. So I think the test is design the right incentives and institutions and muster the coalitions to carry out things that move us more along what seem to me to be completely viable paths that are pro-capitalist in some sense, but allow us for more sharing, for more caring. You can tap people's pocketbooks to help the people who can't take care of themselves. And you can do it institutionally so it doesn't harm the overall economy. But the catch is, it's also viable the other route. So that leaves it sort of, I come out with a choice. And I make no statements, I leave it to the political scientists to figure out the social choices and things like that that people make.
Thank you very much, Richard. Institutions matter for income distribution. It's certainly a proposition I find attractive. I'm just thinking about your Norwegian statistics and institutions. I remember about 9 years ago, I was in Sopot, in the workers' rest home, for those of you who are not sure where Sopot is, near Gdansk. And I was part of an international trade union delegation, which was giving advice to Solidarnosc on how capitalism works. And we were talking about wage bargaining and taxation, and my Norwegian colleague explained the system of wage bargaining and income distribution in Norway, and immediately one of our Polish friends got up and said, "That's communism, Mr. Rigo." So there's certainly multiple models in our systems. Well, thank you, Richard, for that stimulating lecture. There's a time now for questions and discussion. Who would like to take the floor? Richard.
In the case of the Swedes in the US than in Sweden. What puzzles me is how, assuming the skill distribution is similar, how come there's not employers just ganging up to try and find these cheap Swedes? Why isn't the queue of employers at the door of every cheap Swede?
Oh, I assume the skill distribution of the Swedes in the U.S. is similar to the skill distribution of everybody else. Your question is, you're raising it this way. Where does that huge inequality in earnings of Swedish Americans come from? Does it come from their skills because they've been through a school system that has the same flavor as the British school system, does very well at the top and doesn't do so well for people at the bottom? I don't think that the low-skilled person in Minnesota, of Swedish descent is particularly more skilled than a low-skilled person in Boston of Irish descent, or a low-skilled person in New York of Jewish descent. So I don't think there's any, reason to pick out the Swedes as saying, the Swedes all have the same skills and we're just paying them. So that there are great bargains in that sense in the marketplace. I mean, the United States has an incredibly wide distribution for everybody. And as long as I can get a character, pay them $5 an hour and they'll work for me, boom, I will so do, regardless. It would be very interesting though if we got the literacy scores of the Swedes in America versus the Swedes in Sweden. Because we know that the Swedes are the number one on all the literacy, OECD literacy things, and they have an extremely narrow distribution. So the really low-level Swedes, in terms of their reading, writing, and numeracy, are pretty high. And it would be very good to get the Minnesota Swedes for contrast, because that would also be an institutional argument, which is what I it's the way we're developing people in the society, not just in the labor market, but bringing them to the labor market.
Please, right at the back.
I wonder if you'd be kind enough to spell out a little more the implications of your argument for Blairism and New Labour. I got the feeling, listening to your comments, that you actually had a great deal more to say, and I'd be fascinated just to hear a little bit. I mean, does it mean Blairism is a sort of viable proposition, that it's a sensible way to proceed, or what?
Mr. Prime Minister, are you listening? the connection that I see is that there has been a lot of diffuse discussion of stakeholders, of third ways. And in one level, the theme of this is, there are possible ways of doing things differently that are probably helpful or certainly not harmful to the overall productivity of a nation. The other hand, the things I've tried to talk about are more specific. I'm not a great fan of stakeholders if the stakeholders don't also have some actual power to affect decisions. So if you're thinking about a stakeholder versus a shareholder, I'd rather see workers have shares than rely upon management to take care of their interests. Or I'd rather see workers have trade unions, somebody who represents them. So in that sense, I'm uneasy about this. Some of the vague terms, but certainly this is I think it's philosophically, or whatever the right word is, in line with what the UK government, Mr. Blair, Mr. Brown, the path they're going down. And we've got a big project we're going to have at the LSE to study this, as they move along. And hopefully it'll be a report of success 2 or 3 years down the road. It may not be. But beyond that, I mean, somebody who's giving a lecture at the LSE, who has never served in the British Parliament, and who is unlikely to be chosen for the House of Lords, if it exists. I wouldn't say too much.
Yes, I don't think reform of the House of Lords is going to include a special US academic section, but just to say on Blairism, I suppose it's where you stand. I mean, there's a lot happening on the labor front in terms of institutions, minimum wage, social chapter legislation, union recognition legislation. These are quite big changes that are happening in the British labour market, and I know, as Richard was saying, these will be much studied. Now, someone else up there.
As I look at your charts comparing perceived inequality and justifiable inequality, it strikes me that you could interpret them one of two ways. You could go down the path that you took, or you could say that populations with a comparatively lower tolerance for inequality will use their democratic institutions to choose governments that will give them institutions that will produce low inequality. So I guess my question is, to what degree do you think that happens, and to what degree do you think that democracy gives people a meaningful choice of institutions for these outcomes?
Yeah. That's a great question, because that is the alternative interpretation. You're absolutely right. And we have not studied at this point in depth. These results here are very recent. They stunned me, this three-quarters ratio, and you're correct, they could be interpreted the other way. Democracy obviously gives you an ultimate control over the institutions, but it doesn't necessarily give you an ultimate control over the income distribution. Tax lawyers play a big role in that as well. I think of the American democracy, where money counts more. I have the same vote as, I know, Bill Gates has. But in fact, indeed, let me tell you even a better story about this. I got invited to have a breakfast a few years back somewhere in South Carolina with the president. The only thing was I had to contribute $50,000 to his campaign. Now, it wasn't quite phrased that way. But it was from some campaign committee that said, gee, wouldn't it be wonderful for you to join the president in this thing? And then I thought, oh, I could do it. I could do it. But then I thought, who would I be sitting with at the breakfast table? There'd be me. There'd be Bill Gates. There'd be millionaire number three, millionaire number four, all of whom would go to the government in order, they would probably write this $50,000 off as a business deduction, because they would end up getting more breaks for their company as a result of this. So the part of the theory with democracy, as inequality grows, you get a little concerned as the wealthy, the people at the top, may be able to change from a one-man, one vote to a more protecting the well-to-do. I think that is a concern one should have. I wouldn't exaggerate the ability of democracy through the parliamentary system. I'm generally more favorable to private market initiatives on things, which is why I tend to be favorable to trade unions and towards private initiatives that don't require greasing Washington. I mean, here it's a little different because the Labour Party wins, or the Tory Party wins, and they have a parliamentary majority, and it's just much easier to enact legislation. And I think that's true of a lot of the European system. If you have a coalition, it's much harder, because it gives certain groups more power to affect results. In the United States, it's very hard to enact too much legislation. Be clear, we passed the minimum wage bill. The president did not want it. He's in his heart of hearts, he's opposed to the minimum wage, I think. It was forced by a trade union campaign and the fact that 80% of the American people wanted it. And the Republicans voted for it. And you know in their hearts they didn't want it. But they looked at their constituents and everybody was saying, oh, come on, this guy's working, you know, X hours. You're not going to pay him $4.70? You're crazy. And so democracy can rear up, you know, at certain issues. And to be clear, if the president had thought that the minimum wage was a winning issue, he would have supported it. He did not think it was a winning issue. He didn't realize. And it all of a sudden, it just by storm swept through the country. So democracy has those, you know, possibilities. I suppose the answer one really should give is, well, what's the alternative? I wouldn't put my money on too many dictatorships as being more sharing and caring.
Please.
All these capitalist systems have one common objective, pursuit of profit. They also have more or less inequality. Their objective is never human welfare. When it suits them, they are able to reduce the workforce, and a great deal of misery is created. People suffer from the consequence of unemployment, you know. Therefore, this system is not human welfare oriented, except Japan, which has lifetime of employment, which is under threat now at the moment. I saw in Norway a great deal of equality, great deal of equality. There are not many rich people there, not very poor people there. So how do you justify this situation?
Well, I mean, I am a believer in the invisible hand, very strongly, and I do think market capitalism does produce goods for people. Japan is another variant of the system. It is true Japan has an income distribution that is closer to the European income distributions than it is to the American or British. European, I'm not counting Britain as not being part of Europe, of course. But the guys on the other side of the tunnel is what I mean with that. Japan, I if Japan didn't have a capitalist system, they would be in the same boat as the Russians were. I mean, we have these clear-cut experiments: North Korea and South Korea, East Germany and West Germany, that are so striking, and capitalism. And inequality. I'm not opposed to inequality. The issue is how much. Because if everybody gets exactly the same rewards, I doubt that they would work all that hard in any system. I think about this in my classes. I teach, and people here can think about classes they teach or the classes they take. The teacher comes in the first day and announces, everybody gets a B no matter what you do in the class. Boy, that's a certain amount of incentive disappears. You can't differentiate yourself. I think that would be devastating to the incentive structure. So we have to have some inequality. Now, I always have this vision of coming to class and saying, okay, the number one person gets the A Bill Gates Award, and everybody else fails. Now, at that point, you'd have a revolution. So somewhere between these two extremes, and that's what these capitalist systems are really about. And Japan is correct, closer to a more equal system. But there are wealthy people in Sweden. There are wealthy people even in Norway. And we can choose between these, depending, we have some political problem, which was mentioned, how we can get things if we want to choose more one way or more the other way. But it is, I think, a social choice.
Is in the United States, are they doing anything to reduce this income distribution inequality?
Well, we had the minimum wage, which passed. And did something at the very bottom of the income distribution. Generally, I would say no. What is happening is the thing I talked about in the second lecture. We're seeing a lot more sharing of rewards inside companies. But that really doesn't cut at the income distribution problem, because that deals with the upper 40% of the income distribution, or whatever percentage, or reasonably skilled, and so on and so forth. I don't see our government doing very much. They certainly are sufficiently alert to this that we're not going to have a general tax cut. I would be shocked if we did, because everyone realizes that at this point any general tax cut is going to go to the rich, because we have created however many million people at the bottom who basically pay no taxes because they're too poor. The typical person is not going to benefit a whole lot. But there's been no really pro-active movement here. We're seeing more union organizing in the country among very poor people. I said it was a big, tremendous victory won in California among really low skill people. But I think this is, the American society is fully capable of living with a lot of this inequality. So it really is, this is one thing that does require some genuine leadership. And at this point, we don't have a congressional leadership that has any caring about this, I think. The president, I don't think, carries a whole lot of moral authority in the country. And screwed up badly the health care bill, which was an effort. He was elected in part to the health care. Had we gone to universal health care system, that would have been a significant income redistribution to lower income people. I think there is sentiment for things, but exactly how the politician comes who knows how to organize it and sell it to the people. And Clinton's a wonderful politician in many ways, but he didn't do what a lot of people hoped he would do when he would get elected. We certainly hope Mr. Blair is capable of doing it here. I think it does require some serious leadership in organizing these things. It's clear from the minimum wage vote that you can indeed rouse a tremendous pressure for certain redistributive things that people just say, that's fair. I mean, that was the minimum wage, just wasn't in discussion. Just, you can't pay people who are working hard this level of wages. That's insane. And in state after state now, we're seeing state minimum wages going up even faster. So it's much more of a bottom-up at this point than it is a top-down procedure. And it's bizarre, you might say, because you might say, with a huge budget surplus, you can now redistribute large sums of money to poorer people. But, you know, the elderly are a very powerful lobby. And, well, that seems to be the main discussion of our surplus.
Time for one. Towards the back.
Yes. If you, apart from the minimum wage, if you are asked by a government to say, what steps can we take to get fairer shares? Is there any one particular thing that you would put at the top of the list?
The thing I favor the most is greater ownership of capital. So that's what I would go for if I had a choice. I would like to see both workers own and large pension funds which are paying for the Social Security and benefits of people. So people's savings are directed that they become owners directly or indirectly. I suppose that's the thing I would most push. The other thing I don't think any of these things occur, I would say this if Bill wasn't here as well, without a vibrant and thoughtful trade union movement. I don't think there's any other organization that can push some of these things forward. And one of the things in the US, I don't know how the British unions think about this, but certainly in all issues of employee ownership and pensions, the American unions it's one of the few areas where they have really done a major rethink. They're still opposed to works councils. They're uneasy about globalization, things where the TUC is, I'd say, quite progressive. But on this ownership and these other things, they have become much more thoughtful. And you need some force, a political type force, which is what unions are, to push anything like these things through. But I'm very interested to see what the chancellor is going to offer next week in terms of, he will offer some, presumably, tax benefits or something that will encourage precisely these kinds of institutions.
The steps you're talking about seem relevant to those in work.
Yes.
Not to the 10%, the lowest decile, who have no chance of getting any of that share in capital.
Do you want to pass the microphone to the lady?
Well, actually, I was going to say more or less that same thing. And coming from the US, where you have very low unemployment, then perhaps what you're saying makes sense. But if you think Germany, then We didn't have any figures, and it might have been interesting to the income or disposable income, standard of living of the in France and Germany, and the lowest decile income earners in the US.
I've done some comparisons of that type. It turns out that the lowest decile of the French unemployment and social benefits put them fairly high in the U.S. income distribution. I mean, they're like about the 20th or 30th percentile. So they are being taken care of well in that sense. But that was the first thing, really. Sharing you can only do is for the workers. And it's probably not for all workers. That's where the caring part is. You've got to also have programs and policies for other groups. The U.S. does extremely well. And that's why our Social Security is our most popular program. That is the most massive income redistribution program our country has ever had. And it has basically reduced the poverty levels among the elderly to European levels. What's bizarre, to my point of view, is why wait till they get to be 65 and do this distribution? Why not start a bit earlier in their lives with that? But that's very difficult because the elderly see themselves and they're a very powerful voting bloc, and you can be accused of trying to take money from your grandma, and no American wants to be accused of that.
It's time for one more question there in the front. And then perhaps if we could take these two together.
Yes, I'm interested in a different model that you haven't mentioned at all. You said you're in favor of greater ownership of capital. I'm actually interested in reverse, the opposite of that. I'm a director of a company called Scott Barda, where there's no ownership. It's actually about trusteeship in industry. So it's actually a company held in trust for society. So you can't make money out of it. You can't increase wealth from it. You're actually concerned with well-being of society internally in the company and externally for society. Now, it's a smallish company, 100 million or so, but it demonstrates a lot of positive things that can be done. And it basically set up in 1951 to find a middle way, this dreaded word, between capitalism and communism. Okay. Now, people say that this is not, you can't replicate this, this is a special case. But in fact, and this is really a proposal that in your study of Blairism, such as it is in the next 3 years, you may be able to roll this in to your study, that with the massive share buybacks of companies, you know, IBM buying back 2 billion of shares and so on, and with the ownership of shares by pension funds, you may well get into a situation by accident that companies are not actually owned by anybody. And you might end up with a situation of companies like Scott Barda actually held in trust for society. And I just wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
I don't know how different you are from John Lewis.
Very different.
Very, very different. Very, very different. Okay. John Lewis is ownership.
Okay.
Scott
ownership
Barda is
for the employees.
For the employees. Right. Scott Barda is trusteeship for society.
Yeah. There's a whole set of enterprises in the Western world, and I think the U.S. probably has more than anybody else. And we don't call them the third way, but all kinds of charitable organizations, museums, my university. I work for an organization that does what you say. And they have been, I didn't bring the numbers with me, but my guess is they're about 10% of the U.S. economy is made up of institutions, nonprofit, with some social charter of some form. Every millionaire sets up a foundation or something, or gives money to that. One of the interesting things, actually, which would be interesting, it touches upon the question of the gentleman, he's gone now, earlier. The extent to which some of the great things that we've seen our economies or our societies produce have come from the third sector, if I can phrase it that way. You know, we've had a lot of sciences done largely in universities. The LSE must fit into your thing too. So I think there's definitely a place, and there clearly the market has spoken, if I could use the market phrase, the market has spoken. And it says a sizable proportion of activity is done through this way. People will volunteer for an organization set up to do good. No one will go to IBM and say, I volunteer to work for you for free. But they will go and say, I volunteer to work for some charity for free, or work at lower wages in that case. So I think it's a correct point. I would put those organizations more in my first talk, which was the We Caring. These are caring organizations that are supposed to be acting for the social good, and as they see it, they're very large. And indeed, when one of the things, we go to the ex-communist countries, people and many of the U.S. foundations spend a chunk of money trying to encourage independent, nonprofit organizations to do charity, to do thinking about the societies. So you have an independent, et cetera. Some of the discussions of the word would be civic society. It really was meant to be that they're not state and they're not for profit at all. So I have no problem with that. And I say it's on the order of 10% of the U.S. economy is so produced.
Richard, how are you doing for time?
We're 5 minutes over.
Yeah. Perhaps two very quick questions then, one in the front and one at the back.
Oh, that's a good guy up there.
Yeah. Sir, a very short question. I only wanted to come back to the unemployment figures and the income distribution figures you give. And I wanted to ask you, you only give figures for one moment in the time. There is no dynamic in it. I would like to ask you, do you have the impression that the unemployment rates, for example, in Europe, go up as a consequence of the globalization forces? And many, or at least from Germany, we are told that business has to be competitive on a global level. Therefore, the society has to bear consequences such as higher unemployment. And the same thing in concerning income distribution. You don't show, I think, the income distribution has widened over the last time, which then tells me that you just can't choose between different models. There must be some point where all these models are about to converge.
Well, we disagree about that, obviously. And I think there's a vast exaggeration in Europe about the extent to which unemployment is due to globalization and trade with the third world. Germany still runs trade surpluses. So it's awfully hard, if you're doing trade surpluses, to blame trade for your unemployment. No European country imports anything like what the Americans do from China. It's astounding what we import from China. So we are, I think, twice the European proportion of importing from really low-wage countries, and we have full employment. It's true, I mean, it's possible in the German situation. If you look over time, at least the data that I've seen, Germany actually has a reduction of inequality, while the American and the British are having a rise of inequality. It may very well be that reduction of inequality was not a smart thing to do, either at this period of time, or that Germany had a fairly equal income distribution, 15 years ago. There was no point to move in that direction. But I don't see this, I gave them my arguments, that's all, for why I think you're not going to have this convergence. Maybe 10 years from now, you'll stand up and you'll say, well, I knew he was wrong. And lo and behold, I am wrong, but I don't think so.
Okay, one very last question, right?
Somebody, Bill.
Right then. You want to take another one?
Yeah, I want to. These guys have been waving their hands.
One up in the gallery, so they miss me. If we could take the two questions together, gentleman here first, and then gentleman up in the gallery afterwards.
In answer to an earlier question, you advocated the spread of ownership of capital, such as through pension funds. Why limit such benefits to pensioners? Do you not envisage the possibility of setting up similar funds which can be citizen-owned rather than government-owned, which could then create a citizen's income for everybody?
Absolutely. What I said yesterday, but I didn't see it as very feasible at this point, was I wanted these funds set up so that when you were born, you ended up with some shares that would provide a citizen income in that sense. I would have loved to have seen the U.S. budget surplus be used in some such fashion. We do some of that for young people by providing free education, but of course, two-thirds of young people in the U.K., probably at least around half in the U.S., don't go to university or beyond the compulsory schooling. And we have no citizens' income for them. But you could imagine ways of doing that. One of the Democratic senators actually proposed this. And unfortunately, there's no debate over how we should spend our huge budget surplus, since this is the ideal time to do something with it in a positive way. Basically, it's the president saying, give it to the elderly, or hide it so the Republicans can't give tax cuts to the rich. And there's no discussion of using it in a more positive, I think more positive way.
Okay, thank you, Professor, for giving me the time. My question is coming from one of the reasons I have attended your three lectures, which is I do enjoy them very much. I have attended also the Giddings once, and he talked about humanized capitalism, and I was really confused to get in the real life what is humanized capitalism. And you have done very well in the first two lectures about we care, and then the second lecture, we share. And the first lecture, we care, you have explained how the American people and the private sector as the big companies adopted the giving society, giving attitude, sorry. And then when you came to we share, you talk about the production and how the employees now became like stake, what do you call it, stake? That I'm talking from Africa perspectives to if we want to follow the same road of capitalism. And many people, they say that there is no other road. And I think if the Soviet Union is now collapsed and anything, I think the only road is the capitalism. If you want to follow the same road, you will find the same companies, the big companies you are mentioning in America, they are doing oil, mother exploration and doing mining. But the two elements of we care and we share are completely not there. How do you see that?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, I've traveled over Africa. I have some experience in South Africa, where the companies have generally been fairly reasonable in a lot of their policies. I would say this: in Africa, the first thing that has got to be established before we can even talk about these, is of course these types of capitalist institutions, is a successful market system. For that to be established, there has to be protection of property and lives of people. And for that, I think there has to be democracy. It's a little less certain. I mean, Africa, I think it's something like 90% of people in Africa live in economies where the income per head is significantly lower than it was 20-odd years ago. And a lot of this is because very few companies want to invest in sort of a system, and very few Africans want to leave their money in the countries when you have evil dictators who can take it from you. So Africa, I think, is in some sense, it's simpler. thing, if you know how to establish it. You know, it has to be that people feel safe and have their property protected. So then they can do the investing. And then one can go to this, the next level. But until the basic protection of lives and property and the corruption is you know, is driven out. And I think of General Mobutu as the epitome of, I mean, why would anyone want to produce anything when, and we see the Sierra Leone kind of thing. How do you, so the first order has just got to be an establishment of stable, safe countries. And then I think you would see Africa the same way we saw Korea, you know, resources would pour in, people would in fact invest. I mean, I talked to some Africans who just said, look, forget about everything else. We just need some roads so the farmers can get their products to thing, and then we'll sell. And I say, you say, well, why don't you build roads? Well, the World Bank gives money to the country. Well, the politicians steal it. And the roads don't get built. Or if they get built, they're not kept up. And so I think in Africa, in some, one level, it's easier to say what answers would be. But it's obviously been hard. You know, it took Latin America a long time. We've had a lot of dictators there. And we've had problems. But it is very, very basic of establishing the framework for capitalism without worrying for the moment about what brand we would all prefer or we might argue over.
Perhaps we ought to bring it to a close now. We've gone a bit over time. Richard, thanks very much for stimulating so much discussion. And can I say, I can only correct you on one point, there is no TUC CBI t-shirt at the moment, but you never know, there might be one in the not too distant future, but thanks again.